The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
I love it.
Yeah.
Well,
what
Pat,
do you like about it?
Well, Pat, as you know, is very smart. Let's give
he
credit to
is.
Your colleague. And he's an engineer by training, chemical engineering. So when I started doing it first, conversations were great because he knows a bit of science and he knows a bit of engineering. And then what I noticed was he would always ask me a question that I wasn't expecting. That's his skill. You know, yeah. So in other words, he'd read the brief and then go, oh, what about this? Oh, that's interesting. So it's great fun altogether. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, and you notice that though with all Pat's. This is going to turn into a kind of gushing about Pat, but
yeah.
He is, yeah, the intelligence is there. Absolutely.
Is there, yeah.
And it's evident in all the pieces he does every day on the show. So tell me about this chemistry set that your mother bought for you when
you
were a kid.
Yes, I'm glad you've asked. So when I was 12 years of age, my mother must have seen I'm interested in science. She must have seen me watching University Challenge, whatever it was on the telly. And then I get a chemistry set for my birthday.
You're a very advanced 12-year-old.
Well, I was over
University Challenge.
Can you imagine? And I was also watching these boffins. There was like a Magnus Pike. You're probably too young to remember him.
No.
I'd be watching sciencey stuff on the telly. And David Attenborough, the great Attenborough,
yeah,
was a huge hero of all us. Anyway, I got the chemistry set and I loved it. And what I did was I followed the manual, you know, add a bit of salt and this that bored me. So I put every chemical in one test tube,
okay,
stuck it over the bun some burner and it exploded. And my mother came rushing in, what are you doing? She said, you're blowing up the house. So I think it says a lot in that I was trying to do an experiment and be a bit adventurous, you know. And the black mark on the ceiling has been very difficult to remove. Can you believe it? And
really?
I was in my old house, incredible, my bedroom 2 years ago, is still there. The black mark.
No way. Honestly, really? That is gas.
Yeah, whatever the chemicals were, they're they
what were you? Yeah, do you know what this kind of remove? I'm sure if you buy a chemistry set for a kid these days, you know, it's kind of coloured water probably, you know, because of health and safety and everything else. Yeah. What was in it that it exploded?
I can't remember. Potassium permanganate. I remember all these. You must have some chemistry.
Yeah.
Potassium permanganate was there. There was, remember, magnesium and aluminium, and you could light up this magnesium and they would flash. I thought,
yes,
this is brilliant, you know. And I think that might have been the start of it then. My journey into science began with my mother being a good Irish mom, giving me what I wanted for Christmas.
And were they very encouraging, your parents, curiosity?
Well, my mother was, but my dad had no interest in science. He would say, oh, don't be doing that. And I always remember when I was studying for my finals all those years ago in Trinity, and I did biochemistry in Trinity in the 80s, he gave me a history book while I was revising. And I said, what are you doing? He said, you got to be a bit more broader than just focusing in on that. But he was always encouraging me to read. You know,
yeah,
and be knowledgeable about things, I guess, was his thing.
And when you got into secondary school then, that curiosity kind of born of Attenborough and everything and fueled to a degree by your potassium permanganate and everything that your mother allowed you to ignite in your bedroom, how was that fostered in school?
Well, very. Now, again, no more than yourself, I like science. I liked English as well, though. It wasn't just science.
Yeah.
But then in fifth year, I had a fantastic teacher, and many of us would talk about an inspirational teacher, Fran Mooney by name, and I still see Fran. He's retired now, and he got us, and everybody was turned onto biology by him. And my evidence for this is, I was thinking about it on the way up, so remember the Oral Irish, they would ask you what your favourite subject was,
mm-hmm,
and we all said Beholiacht, which is the Irish for biology. So, and I remember Fran telling us, why did you all say that? Oh, because it was great. And he was inspirational. I think it says he was young. I think we were his first class.
Yeah.
And his nickname was Shaggy, because he looked like Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. He had long hair.
Yeah.
But he got me, and he got me into biology.
And can you remember what it was that it was so engaging about him?
DNA. I'll never forget. He got at the blackboard one day, got a piece of chalk out, and he sketches this double helix.
Mm.
He said, now, boys, that's the basis for all genes and genetics and inheritance. And he began describing how it was discovered. And I guess he had a way of describing these things that was very accessible. And then secondly, then once we got onto the more medical bits, and about the immune system, I even remember that began to get me as well. Oh, that's interesting. Mm. And I almost did medicine in a university, actually, because I was intrigued by diseases even then. I think it's like any great teacher. And many of us would agree that it's all about the teachers, isn't it, in a sense? And let's say I had come across a great mathematics teacher, I could have been a mathematician. It's a bit of luck, I think, it's involved in this.
And when you've kind of found yourself in front of students, like that word you use about kind of accessibility.
Yeah.
Is that something you're conscious of?
Very much so, yeah. And in fact, how I got into the more media stuff was I began teaching first years biology in Trinity then, if you fast forward. And can you imagine, Kieran, having 250 of them, 18 years of age, sitting in front of you? You know, how do you get them interested? Now, they've chosen biology, so that's quite good.
So you're on a good starting point.
Yeah, you're pushing an open door.
Yeah.
But you can still put them off, remember.
Yeah.
I knew that from my own experience in university. So I realised realised, how do I tell them these things that are very complicated in a way that might engage them? And I think ultimately it does become storytelling in a strange way to make it interesting. So I'd often tell the story of the scientist who made the discovery, because some of these scientists are wackos. Let's put it that way, a bit strange. And that's something that people can relate to as well. So there's ways to do it to get people engaged.
And am I right in thinking, I mean, all of this might never have happened, that there was a point in time in which you nearly took a job in the city of London?
There was. Yeah, well, eventually I decided to do a PhD, which is your entry level.
You rejected level your dad's attempt to kind of steer you towards a history degree.
I defied him on purpose just to annoy him. So I go to London to do my PhD, and this is the mid 80s when Thatcher was in the ascendant and there were guys in the city, you know. And when I got my PhD, some of my fellow PhD graduates got jobs in the city. Mm. In fact, the banks would come around recruiting. And I was interviewed by the HSBC and they offered me a job in finance, thinking he must be smart, you know.
Yeah.
And I did think about it. I said, well, hang on a minute, that might be a road to go down, you know, and I had a good think. And then I eventually realised, nah, I don't want to be like one of those guys, a Hooray Henry type in the city. So that kind of put me off.
What would have been the attraction? Just probably the salary, was it?
At that time, as you may have seen, they were quaffing champagne, these guys, in the city of London.
Yeah.
It was a bit obscene in a way. You know, it seemed very exciting and glamorous. And a way to make loads of money, of course, because many went into the city and began to make, and some of my contemporaries did that. And they go, that might be a way to make some money. That was attractive as well. But ultimately, it wasn't for me, because I was a dyed-in-the-wool scientist by then. I said, no, I'll stick with the science, was the decision I made then.
Because the reason I ask, was it the money, the attraction, is there another career you could imagine yourself having done that would have that would have elicited the same kind of sense of satisfaction?
Maybe teaching, probably, actually, would be the two I'd look at, you know,
because
I'm a teacher anyway in university. So teaching, from the inspiration, I guess, I had in secondary school, I guess I was a teacher. Maybe owning a bookshop, like reading those, academic-y, you know.
Yeah.
But it had to be a university for me in the end, because once I got into them and I realised these are really interesting places to work, they're full of very bright people, they're discovering new things and you're passing it on to the next generation. It seemed to be the perfect combination of things to do, really, at university.
What type of bookshop would you own?
Oh, there's a science one. You wouldn't sell many books.
You couldn't just have a science book.
No, you could
have
a
corner of your bookshop.
I love the, all these old bookshops you wander into occasionally in towns around Ireland, and they're lovely bookshops, aren't they?
Yeah.
The bookseller's obviously a very sound person, and there's a big mishmash of different books. A quirky, eccentric one, I think. Not one of the big chains. That'd be too boring. You know, I'd rather have my own little one that I would.
What's the most recent book you've read?
Oh, the most recent book I've read is, I'm reading a book at the moment. It's called The Terroir of Whiskey. It's a book all about the science of whiskey.
Oh, yeah.
And they're making the case that whiskey has a terroir. Now, wine has a terroir, as you probably know, the Burgundies and Bordeaux. Can whiskey really have a local flavour? And of course, if you drink scotch, you realise it's very smoky. So it's all about how you make whiskey and the different types of whiskey. And that's got my attention at the moment.
And is it always information, fact, science? Do you ever sit down with just a kind of a good old thriller? Who done it?
As I got older, I got sick of fiction. I don't know what, some story about something, you know.
Yeah.
I got more and more. I think that happens when you become middle-aged as a man.
You're not one of these people who feels you've got the kind of the great American novel in you trying to get out, no?
Don't think so.
No.
I got drawn more and more to non-fiction. I don't know about you, but reading another story didn't really get to me, I guess. I haven't read a novel in a while, but early on I read lots of novels, of course, but now it's non-fiction.
Where does kind of seeing your name on books then in bookshops, given like that's kind of this alternative life maybe you imagine for yourself, where does that rank in terms of thrill compared to, you know, that doing the stuff with Pat, getting recognised maybe on the street for that, or even like kind of the success in academia or with the business, anything?
It's a thrill and a half when you walk by, you know, Dubray, and you sit your book in the window, you go, wow, that's really interesting. And when my first book came out, it was called Humanology, I did go into a few bookshops and, oh, there it is on the shelf. I think it's partly because it's such an effort to write and you're just satisfied to see it out there.
Did you linger around and see if anybody picked it up or anything?
I moved them all to the front, first of all.
That's very important.
And I told my friends to go into every bookshop in Ireland and get them onto the table just to try and sell them. But it's such a thrill when you because it's a huge amount of effort. It's great.
Yeah.
And then when people start to read it and they begin to tell you they're getting something out of it, that's the next next thing in the process. But it's not as big a threat as making a discovery as a scientist. Because first of all, I am a scientist. And us scientists, that's our job. You've got to make a brand new discovery. Mm. And when that began happening during my PhD, it began actually. There's nothing to match that because you're seeing something that nobody's ever seen before in the world. And you're adding to the sum total of knowledge in the area. And then you usually publish a paper anyway. You get your name on a publication as well. And that's quite nice too. But the thrill of discovery is what it's all about, really.
And talk me through that. I mean, when you begin to see results, I assume there's this precarious period whereby you don't know whether what you're seeing is going to ever come to fruition, whether there'll ever be any application to it, whether it's actually real. Maybe there's kind of some problems in terms of interpretation and the data or anything else.
You've got it. It's torture.
Okay.
No, it is, honest to God. Yeah. And I teach loads of students to do PhDs and I tell them you're going to fail 90% of the time here because your idea is wrong. You can't do the experiment properly for whatever reason. The chemicals aren't right and you're failing a lot, right? So that's why when you do actually see something that's true, then you go, wow, it's a bit like climbing Everest in a sense. But I'm only ever fully happy when we publish our paper and another lab in America or Japan reproduces our work, because now we know it's true. There's always a risk of an artifact, the Liffey water or something like that.
Yes.
Can't control for you, you know. So it's only when you see someone else repeat your work that you know, oh, that discovery is important. And then they begin to cite you. That we like citations. It's a bit like likes. You know, that's good as well. No, but you need to make sure that your stuff is real and that it's true. But it's torture because things are often wrong.
It's funny, isn't it? You kind of exist in almost two different worlds to a degree, don't you? I mean, there's the Luke O'Neill that people listening to this will know and the Pat Kenny stuff and the high street bookshop books, as it were. But then you've got your kind of Japanese academics who are reproducing your work, and they don't probably refer to you as the guy from the Pat Kenny show. You know what I mean? They don't know about that.
It creeps in there, because if they Google me, they'll say this.
They ask you to bring the guitar and things like this.
I don't like it especially, because I see it's sort of, you know, as a scientist, you want to be seen as a scientist, remember, not someone in the media. But I see it as a continuum. I think once I began teaching those teenagers and began to like it, I suddenly realised, oh, communicating science is good, you know? And next thing, then News Talk came along, and now I began doing that. And it only took off in the pandemic, as you know, because I was needed even more then. Mm. You know? And suddenly this went through the roof. But even before that, I was with Pat since 2013, remember? So, but it's a funny one. Yeah, they're quite distinct. They're similar in that I do teach, and it's the same. I see it as the same thing. I could be lecturing an 18-year-old, or I gave a talk to the U3A, which is this Retired People's Association the other week, for instance. I see no difference. You know, it's just describing science that interests me and might interest them. So I see it as the same sort of thing.
Is there a role for AI in the type of science you do?
Yeah, increasingly. And that's the big buzz at the moment anyway. So we use AI. I mean, lots of labs, you have to use it really. And it's the way to do it, because as a human, you can only read so much. I'll give you one example. So if I was to read all the papers in biochemistry, it'd take me decades, right, to read them all. Mm. AI can read them in seconds. And then you can ask a question. You know, you're hoping the AI can then use that information to answer a question is one example. The second one is drug discovery. So AI can sort through millions of molecules and pick one with the right properties to target a disease process. So the whole drug discovery business is accelerating because of AI. So we're using it more and more as a key tool, really.
And so are we kind of on the precipice of kind of epochal change in that sense, or is this just something that speeds up stuff that was already happening?
You got to watch the hype. You got to be careful. Yeah. Remember, usually when something comes along, it's overhyped. I think it's going to increasingly become more and more important as it proves itself. Some are still thinking, oh, humans can do better. Not everybody agrees. It's the best thing to use, for instance. It can make mistakes, for instance, or it can misinterpret things.
Yeah.
But the best ever was...
tell you to put glue on a pizza.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
It would tell me, don't put all those chemicals together and then I might make a discovery. You know,
Mightn't have blown that hole in the roof of the family bedroom.
But the Stanford AI review comes out every year, and it was superb this year. It was all about the advances in science. And one big example was the first ever proper trial where cardiologists used it to diagnose someone versus ones who didn't. And the ones who used it, there was 30% less mortality from heart disease if you use the AI. To look at all the scans.
Yeah.
Now, that was a really good experiment because it was controlled. It was the same bunch of cardiologists, remember? You use it or not, and there was a 30%. Now, can you imagine, if I was to sell a tablet that would decrease your risk of dying by 30%, you jump at it.
Yeah.
So what that means is this will now be adopted as a tool for cardiologists to use, for example. So we're going to see more and more medical uses coming in.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I often cite a medical example when people... AI conversations, they're often in the abstract, and there's actually a really tangible example up in the Mater where they're using it now to interpret scans. Yep. And now there's still a kind of a human fail-safe that when a scan is bumped to the top of the queue, a radiologist has to sit down and go through it.
That's right.
But they don't have to go through the 150 scans with nothing on them before they get to the one with something malignant.
And it's millions of scans, remember, is in that database, and they see a new one and they can compare it to the millions in seconds. It's incredible technology for that. But as I say, we need more evidence, like I just mentioned, that it really is providing benefits, and the hope is it will, based on what we've seen so far.
And, I mean, is there a role for art, like, as in... You obviously had this great breakthrough in terms of kind of immunology and the work in arthritis and all of that. I mean, but are we more generally technology adopters than technology leaders?
Oh, that's a good question. I think scientists will use whatever technology they can, basically, to answer their questions. So when the telescope was invented, you can imagine Galileo could see all these stars and planets, couldn't he? He had to use a telescope, didn't he? Or when the microscope, even more important, you can now see bacteria. You know? So every time a new technology comes along, if you're a good scientist, I'll use it. I can see an application to answer my questions. And that's the way to think of it. Now, meanwhile, there are the people developing the technologies, and they're the real boffins, if I can use that word.
Yeah.
They're often very nerdy kind of guys. You know, and I know some of them. Like the ones doing AI, they're computer geeks, really. But they're making big advances in terms of how to deploy this. You see? Yeah. And then I'd know them. I'd meet them at a conference. I'd go, can I collaborate with you? I don't know. There's a black box. I put my data in and get something out.
I don't need to know what happens inside that black box.
My nerdy friend does. That's your business, you know. But I don't need to know as long as I can get an answer out of it. So that's the way to think of it, you know.
Yeah, listen, it's an exciting world. And unfortunately, we're out of time to talk about it anymore. Luke, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks a million for coming into us.
Thanks very much, Kieran.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.